and a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. Don't forget that you can take the show 24/7 on demand on your own time by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. We'll have more from them coming up a little bit later on in the program this morning. We had our monthly hangout last night for the members of the Nick Craig Show Patreon, and it was a great conversation. Talked about a lot of pertinent issues, of course, the Senate race here in North Carolina, veto overrides. Great conversation with everybody last night. We'll have another one of those coming up here in a couple of weeks towards the middle and end of August. And again, you can get access to that, daily show notes, and more by supporting the show. You can do that over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. All right, we've got a busy Thursday for you this morning as we look at what happened yesterday. I mentioned this. We talked about this probably early last week. The Federal Reserve had a meeting scheduled, and of course, this was after President Donald Trump and Jerome Powell toured the multi-billion dollar renovation of the Federal Reserve building, Trump hammering Powell over the cost, hammering Powell over interest rates. And even before this meeting and the meeting took place, the vote took place, and the press conference happened, all the rumor was, and it seemed incredibly likely, that interest rates would remain exactly where they have been since December of last year. And while that's exactly the case, as the Federal Reserve voted yesterday to keep interest rates unchanged. At a press conference following Wednesday's Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, meeting, Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, announced that the central bank will continue to target an interest rate between 4.25% and 4.5%. That is where it has remained since December. This, of course, comes despite President Donald Trump urging Powell to lower the rates. And for the first time in more than 30 years, two members on the in the FOMC dissented with Jerome Powell and the rest of the board to keep interest rates exactly where they are. Fed Governor Christopher Waller and Vice Chair of Supervision Michelle Bowman, who I will note are both Trump appointees, said that they preferred to cut rates by a quarter of a percentage point. Walker has been cited as a possible nominee to replace Powell when he retires as the Fed chair next May, or if Trump puts so much pressure on him and gets him to quit before that period of time. And just to go and show you how historic this is, and it is, the last time that two Fed governors dissented with the rest of the body was 1993. So you have to go back more than 30 years to find the last time that two Federal Reserve board member, board of governor members disagreed with the rest of the group. So it is accurate to say that this does not happen all the time. It is accurate to say that this is not a normal situation that unfolds. When the Federal Reserve has these meetings a couple of times a year, everybody is in lockstep agreement. And the fact that you've got dissension now within the Federal Reserve, which makes complete and total sense, but the fact that you've got this level of dissension now, which I will note was also rumored, we talked about that last week, that a couple of board members could potentially defect, I guess would be the proper word to use, from the rest of the board, highlights growing frustration with Jerome Powell, growing frustration with the central bank and their unwillingness to lower rates. And a lot of folks, I think rightfully so, are starting to question and ask whether this is being done truly for an economic reason or if this is being done for political purposes. And when you look at President Donald Trump, and you look at his first term in office, you look at the last couple of months now of his second term in office, we see a lot of decisions being made all over the board, all over the map. Decisions being made for purely political reasons against the president of the United States. This is not a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory that the Federal Reserve or some other entity is doing things for a hyper-political reason. We have got example after example again, going back to the first term of Trump's presidency, and now that very clearly show that decisions are being made to not help the president in his agenda. And I will remind you, this is the same Federal Reserve that right before the presidential election, with the economy being the number one issue on the voters' minds across the United States of America, this same Federal Reserve, after keeping interest rates exactly where they had been, decided right before the election, we're going to lower rates. They did that in September of last year to provide a little bit of cover, provide a little bit of runway to the Democrats. There was no other explanation why they lowered rates in September except for the fact that it was likely a political decision, that it was likely done in conjunction with the Biden administration and the Democrats to provide them some cover on the economy. Because when you looked at political polling leading up to the election, when you looked at what was driving individuals out to polling locations across the United States, the top two issues were the economy and immigration. We know the immigration issue was completely botched by the Democrats. There was no way for them to spin that around. There was no way for them to tie a nice little bow on immigration and somehow course correct on 4 years of disastrous policy. So that was a lost cause. They just had to move on from that. But the economy, with some help from our good friend Jerome Powell at the Fed, you know, you might make a little bit of an impact there. Get some big get some headlines. Tell the American people that we're continuing to lower rates and we're making it more affordable to buy a home, buy a car, and some of those big time, big ticket purchases that American consumers have to deal with. And so this idea, and of course now it's called a conspiracy theory because that's how everything is with the left. This notion, this concept, this idea that these decisions are being made, not purely, but are the political backstory, the political machine behind all of this is swaying these decisions by the Fed, I do not think is a conspiracy theory. I do not think it is unfounded. You can't explain the September rate cuts last year, except for they were purely political. Inflation was still on the rise. There was no reason for rates to be cut at all, except for to provide cover for the Democrats. And now here we are, one day away from August 1st, halfway through the year, halfway through 2025, and the Federal Reserve hasn't done a damn thing since December. That's the last time they cut rates, right before Joe Biden left the Oval Office and President Donald Trump was inaugurated. And in the, three or four meetings that they've had this year, rates have remained unchanged. This all while the economy continues to improve. And it is, and it does. And that it dovetails into a story we're going to be talking about a little bit later on this morning, an interesting opinion piece over at the New York Times. Here is Jerome Powell speaking yesterday after the meeting. This is what he had to say.
Total PCE prices rose 2.5% over the 12 months ending in June. And that, excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core PCE prices rose 2.7%. These readings are little changed from the beginning of the year, although the underlying composition of price changes has shifted. Services inflation has continued to ease, while increased tariffs are pushing up prices in some categories of goods. Near-term measures of inflation expectations have moved up on balance over the course of this year on news about tariffs, as reflected in both market-based and survey-based measures.
And here's the thing. Is there a possibility, and I might even argue a strong possibility, that tariffs are going to push up prices? Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons that some folks on the right, myself included, have not been necessarily running around waving the flag on tariffs, because there is that very real risk, and just looking at it from a purely economic standpoint, there is a very real risk that tariffs cause, at least short term. Now, long term, it's unknown. It remains to be seen. But especially in the short term, an increase in prices. That is a very real thing that the president has to deal with. It's a very real question he has to answer. And I will argue that it's a relatively large gamble. I've made this point, you know, many a times in over the last couple of years back on the radio here in Wilmington. One of the things that makes politics such an interesting sport to follow, and what makes politics so tough, is to make dramatic changes, which is what a lot of folks, I think, want. They are very unsatisfied. They are very unhappy with the current state of politics. They're pissed off with the division. They're pissed off with spending and all of the variety of issues that people say are a problem with government. But here's the issue. To start changing these things is the equivalent of turning around a cargo ship. It's a very slow process. It does not happen immediately. And it's something that takes a significant amount of time. And so the gamble and the risk is in this process, Trump wants to bring back some level of American manufacturing. He campaigned on that. It has been a large discussion since he's took his oath of office and got back in the White House. It is something that I believe he feels strongly about. It's something he is consistently talking about, and it drives, I believe, a large part of the tariff discussion. When you're saying, we want to bring manufacturing back to the United States, I have some disagreements with the president on the practicality and if that actually makes any sense at all. Taking my thoughts and comments aside, that's what the president wants to do. That is what he has set his eye on. That does not happen immediately. That does not happen with the snap of a finger. That is a long-term change and a very lengthy process that unfolds to bring that manufacturing back to the United States. And so the setup on all of that, I mention all of that and I give you that backstory to lay out the political risk that these big decisions have. The question is, can American consumers and will American consumers be willing to deal with some potential short-term pressure, some short-term pain with increase in prices immediately due to tariffs? Because the impacts are, for the most part, relatively quick. They only lag by maybe 90 or 180 days, relatively short-term in the grand scheme of things. Will American consumers and will the American populace deal with those short-term struggles, those short-term pains for potentially long-term gains and long-term success? That is the political calculation that has to be made. Again, like turning around an aircraft carrier, it does not happen very quickly. It is a slow process. And the unfortunate reality that this administration is dealing with is consumers have been dealing with high prices for years now. This is not something that just started 18 or 20 months ago. You go all the way back to the early parts of 2021, and you start seeing those prices increase as you get into the summer of 2022. Inflation is at 9.5%. It's the largest inflation percentage in like 50 years. In the summer of 2022, yes, it has come down from that. It could only go down. There was no way it could possibly go any higher. So it has come down, but prices continue to remain elevated. And so middle-class American and lower middle-class American consumers have been feeling the pinch. They have been feeling the pain now, in some cases, for 3.5, 4.5 years. So do they have not only the willingness, but the true financial ability to deal with some of these short-term price increases? That has been my thoughts on tariffs from the very early days. It is a very risky political maneuver. I am of the mindset that in the long term, it probably works out for the United States. I think that's a fair assessment and a fair assumption. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know that that's for certain. The things that the administration is saying and the things that I believe that they are putting in place, kind of the foundation, the groundwork that they're laying, could be very beneficial to the United States long term. There is no argument. I'm not going to make the argument against that point. Can they deal with the lead up and the build up until we get to that point? And that remains unanswered. To me this morning, that remains unknown. I'm not sure if they are willing to deal with that. Now, prices and inflation have continued to moderate and in some cases in certain sectors and areas go down and other sectors go up. A lot of that is due to some of the uncertainty, which there's an incredible amount of as it relates to tariffs. So that question remains unknown. But back to the Federal Reserve meeting yesterday, back to Jerome Powell's comments yesterday. I believe, and I am of the strong belief and opinion, that the unwillingness to lower rates is being done purely politically. This is the same guy that cut interest rates just a couple of months before the election when inflation was at, I don't know, it was 6.5-7%, somewhere in that ballpark right before the election. There was absolutely no reason for him to cut rates. Zero justification. But he did it. Why did he do it? Because it was beneficial to the Democrat Party. It was beneficial to the party that was trying to regain or continue to hold power, I should say, in the White House. So when you look at some of those numbers, you look at core inflation, you look at the less volatile markets like energy and food and things of that nature, there is good reason for rates to be cut. Now, the Federal Reserve meets again in September, so nothing in the month of August, but they will meet again in September. And their rumor is already, even though we're more than a month away from that meeting, almost 2 months away from that meeting, there is already rumor that rates will be cut at least one basis, which is a quarter percent, which is, I think, one basis point at their meeting coming up in September. Slowly starting the process of unraveling the Federal Reserve, unraveling these interest rates, and allowing people to borrow money. Allowing individuals to go out and purchase homes and purchase cars. And yes, obviously, you can do those things right now. You're more than willing and able to go out and purchase a house, but because of mortgage rates that are in the mid sixes and have been stuck in that period for quite some time, it is for many families and many individuals completely and totally impractical to do so, because what was a $1,500 or $1,700 mortgage payment is now $2,500 a month. The property value has gone up, sure, and the difference between 2.25% and 6.5% on your mortgage rate is hundreds of dollars a month, every single month, for the, if you keep that rate over a 30-year loan or a 15-year loan. It's an incredible amount of extra dollars. So you've seen the housing market continue to shrink as well, because, and you're seeing property sit on the market significantly longer than it was just a couple of years ago, where literally you'd be nailing a sign into your yard that said for sale, and you've got seven people at your door ready to walk around the house, and in some cases pay $20,000 or $30,000 over asking price cash to just get in there. I mean, that's what the housing market was just a couple of years ago with lower interest rates. You go back to 2018, 2019, 2020, and about midway or so through 2021 until those mortgage rates started going up. That's what the housing market was. I mean, nothing was sitting on the market. Literally, you'd list a house on a Friday, and there was a very strong possibility that you had an offer the same day, if not by the end of the weekend. And in some cases, multiple offers over asking price. Now, yes, still a red-hot real estate market. North Carolina, I would argue, is maybe a little bit of an outlier. Our boom in population, the growth, the extensive growth that we're seeing in this state, thanks to Republican control in the General Assembly that continues to make this state a friendly place to live, a friendly place to do business, a relatively affordable place for businesses and families, we continue to see that boom. So prices of property are way up all across the state. And of course, you add that in with the 6.5% mortgage rate, and now you're seeing homes sit on the market 8, 9, 10, 11, 2 weeks. I mean, they're sitting on there for a period of time. It's not months, but compared to less than 24 hours, which is what it was a couple of years ago, you now have property sitting on the market for 7, 8, 9, 10 days. So there absolutely is some level of cooling off in the real estate market. And a lot of that is hard to paint with a broad brush, because there are various factors that exist in specific markets. For example, Wilmington is probably a little bit of an outlier. It's a very, very hot real estate market right now. Property values are freaking sky high. Mortgage rates are high. Raleigh and Charlotte have similar markets as well, except they're a little bit different because they continue to expand outward as well. So all of those factors pile into the struggle that American consumers are dealing with. the struggle that American families are dealing with. If they have to relocate for work, if they have to move to a different state, if they've outgrown the house that they're currently living in, maybe wanting to have another child or two. It is very impractical to do a lot of that. And specifically when you look at the housing market, specifically when you look at the real estate market, the Federal Reserve's current benchmark rate of 4.25% to 4.5% is keeping those mortgage rates where they are. No, that is the process. That is how that works. So if the Fed, fingers crossed, starts to lower those rates, which presumably could come as early as the month of September with their next meeting, as the Fed begins to lower those rates, you will see mortgage rates trail behind that and, begin to lower as well. And then you'll see some sort of probably a more secondary boom in the real estate market. I mean, that's how this process unfolds. So back to the meeting yesterday, the FOMC statement said that recent indicators suggest that that the growth of economic activity moderated in the first half of the year. This statement is a revision from its June statement that indications suggested that the economy continued to expand at a solid pace. Trump has continued to attack Jerome Powell for keeping interest rate at what he believes is an elevated level. The 47th president of the United States has also criticized Powell over the cost of renovation of the nation's central bank headquarters, which has far exceeded its initial estimates. Now, going back to the two individuals, the two Fed governors who dissented with the rest of the board, Christopher Waller has made his case for cutting interest rates in a recent speech, stating, first, tariffs are one-off increases in the price level and do not cause inflation beyond a temporary surge, adding that standard central banking practice is looking through such price level effects as long as inflation expectations are anchored. He also added, second, a host of data argues that monetary policy should be close to neutral, not restrictive. And that's what a 4.25%, 4.5% interest rate does. It is intentionally trying to constrain the market. It is intentionally trying to restrict the flow of money to bring down inflation. When the interest rate at the Federal Reserve is zero, it is a lot cheaper to borrow money, buy a house, buy a car, get a loan for a business, borrow money from the bank. It is a lot cheaper to do that when the interest rate is zero. When it's 4.5%, 4.25%, it becomes more expensive to borrow that money. Therefore, it restricts, it constrains the economy. That's the process that the Federal Reserve and the experts like Jerome Powell over there, that's what they try and manage. It, I would argue to this point, has not necessarily been super successful. I think the frustration and the struggle right now is largely related around the real estate market. The economy is improving. These trade deals, President Donald Trump last night announced a major trade deal with South Korea. That was announced last night. We'll get a few of those details in a few minutes. Things are looking very good. The tariff deadline is tomorrow, so we'll see what the administration has to say on that. Things are going really good. But the housing market has essentially stalled right now. It has stalled and it will continue to stall because you can't sell, buy, or refinance a property because mortgage rates are too high. I mean, you've got a lot of people here, look at the property increases here in New Hanover County. And you might say, wow, my house is worth $550,000. Right, great. I bought it for $310,000 and it's now worth $550,000. Great. But you can't sell your house for $550,000 and purchase a larger house. You're purchasing the same, if not a smaller piece of property at that same price because property values are up and the housing market is essentially stalled thanks to Jerome Powell and the morons over at the Federal Reserve that I believe for political reasons will not reduce rates. And it's seriously constraining, I think, the work that the Trump administration is trying to do and the attempts that they're trying and the things that they're trying to do to upset the economy and get things back to some level of normalcy. So that is the latest that we are tracking out of the Federal Reserve. Another meeting expected in September for the first time in over 30 years. Two Board of Governors members did dissent in the final vote. So that kind of sets the stage and maybe shines a little bit of a light on what we could see coming up in a couple of maybe potential rate cuts later this year. We'll keep an eye on the details right here on the Nick Craig Show. In some other news this morning, again, keeping it on the economy, President Donald Trump announced yesterday that the United States has struck a major trade deal with South Korea, matching the structure of PACs with Japan and the European Union. The deal brings clarity to the United States' relationship with South Korea, which is a major trading partner, and will be a relief to automakers and other heavily exposed industries that rely on the South Korean market. Like the Japan deal, it also leaves some level of unanswered questions exactly how some of this will play out. However, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said that the Trump administration has also struck trade deals with Cambodia and Thailand on Wednesday as well. He announced that on the Sean Hannity show last night. With this, South Korea will buy $100 billion in U.S. energy products, according to the president. The deal also includes a $350 billion investment fund, though it's not immediately clear exactly how that investment fund will roll out, but that's the agreed upon number right now. President Trump also said South Korea would separately invest a large sum of money for their investment purposes into the United States as that meeting took place. As it stands right now, South Korea is one of the largest United States trading partners, the source of more than $131 billion worth of U.S. imports last year. So as we get closer to this August the 1st deadline, of course, that is coming up tomorrow, you're seeing many more of these deals come into picture, really come to fruition as many of these countries are being pressed and pushed to come to the negotiating table and make a deal. So another major trade deal met. It's been a very good week for the president in terms of those trade deals, a major one with the EU earlier this week, a major trade deal with Japan, and now South Korea. So things are definitely working well for the president, at least on the tariff trade deal front, and we'll continue to track those details. All of this is exemplified in an interesting piece from Brett Stevens, who is an opinion writer over at the New York Times. He's got an article out that says the Trump presidency takes a better turn. This is a very interesting piece. We'll get into the details on that coming up here in just a few minutes. But before that, I want to let you know that when legal challenges arise, it's unfortunate, but sometimes they do. When that happens, make sure you put your trust in the law group here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across eastern North Carolina. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong defense, the law group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. They're located in downtown Wilmington and just a quick phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or their website, lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate the Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. We'll get into this New York Times opinion piece on Trump's presidency coming up after this. You're listening to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. And a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome back to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook, 24/7. Wherever you get your podcasts. I caught a very interesting opinion piece over in the New York Times yesterday. The headline is this, and it's by an individual by the name of Brett Stevens, who is an opinion columnist over at the New York Times. The Trump presidency takes a better turn. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of go through and read it this morning because it comes from the standpoint of somebody that is, you know, hoping Trump fails and him having to give the president a little bit of credit for some of his accomplishments. So we'll dive into those details this morning. It starts off by saying, after a disastrous first 100 days. So that's the launch pad. If you need to know anything about this individual's ideological bend or their political opinions, this is the open. After a disastrous first 100 days, Donald Trump is starting to have a much more successful presidency. This is not what we, his foam-at-the-mouth critics, had planned or perhaps secretly hoped for. That's the stage. This is a guy who is hoping that he would have a bad presidency, which really goes to show you how screwed up in the head these people are. You should not want, as an American, a president, even if you disagree with them politically, you should not want a president to have a disastrous presidency. Because that is not good for the country in which you live. That is not good for the country in which you are a citizen of. You know, American prosperity, regardless of what political party makes it happen, is good for everybody involved. But of course, for Democrats, they want to see Donald Trump fail. They want to see Republicans fail. Even though that will hurt America, they're just so ideologically screwed up that that's what they believe. Nevertheless, let's get into some of the details. Some of this is a function of good policy, like getting NATO's European members and Canada to spend much more on their defense, something previous American presidents asked for, but much too politely. Far from destroying the Atlantic alliances, as his critics feared, Trump may wind up here being remembered for reviving and rebalancing NATO to the advantage of both sides. Some of this is courageous policy. Joining Israel in its strikes on Iran, which Trump carried out in the teeth of political resistance from parts of his own base. It did not lead us into a calamitous Middle East war, though Tehran may seek retaliation. Instead, it helped to bring the war between Israel and Iran to a swift end, and as the Washington Post reported, did such severe damage that Iran's nuclear program will be neutered for a very long time. Some of this is belated good policy. Speeding the diversity of arms to Ukraine after Trump's disastrous initial pressure campaign on Ukraine backfired by emboldening Vladimir Putin is the only way to end the war. The next step for Trump is to make good on his sanctions threat, ideally by seizing Russia's foreign frozen assets so they can finance Ukraine arms purchases. I disagree with that completely, but this is this guy's opinion on it. Some of this is good policy that's gone too far. We no longer have a migration crisis, an achievement that should not have eluded the Biden administration for most of its term and that cost the Democrats dearly. But Americans want an immigration policy that secures the border and deports criminals, not one that goes after law-abiding, hardworking, undocumented immigrants on whom many areas of the economy's deepened many areas of the economy depend and who should be given a viable pathway to citizenship. Also disagree on that last point as well. But, you know, it says an interesting thing there. We no longer have an immigration crisis, an achievement that should not have been eluded the previous administration for most of its term and cost them dearly. And that's exactly the case. The failure of Democrats to deal with immigration, which was absolutely a problem, very much screwed them in November of last year. It was, I might argue, and it's hard because you have really the economy as well, but between immigration and the economy, very, very hard for Democrats to try and make a salient argument to the American people that they are the party, they have the policies, the platforms, the ideas that give the American people the success and prosperity that they are looking at. It then goes on to say some of this is bad policy that could have been much worse. The trade deals that Trump has recently struck with Japan and the European Union will raise costs for American consumers and hurt American businesses, especially smaller ones. But they also expand markets for American exporters, including cars and agricultural products. After months of the White House's erratic trade sanctions and rhetoric, the trade deals bring a predictability and clarity. Some of this also comes down to a series of partisan victories. The big, beautiful domestic policy bill had many unbeautiful parts, but as a policy matter, the administration needed it to pass, and it did. The directives abolishing diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in the federal government will not sit well with many Democrats in the country, but it doesn't seem to be costing Trump his significant support among Black and Hispanic voters. The way to get universities to crack down on anti-Semitism should not be threatening their research funding. But the $200 million settlement that the administration reached with Columbia probably ensures that the university won't again make the mistake of letting campus fanatics run wild. And then finally, there's luck. Widespread fears of a recession haven't materialized. Instead, the economy appears to be growing at a healthy clip, and the S&P 500 is up around 10% since the election. The Democrat Party's approval rating is at a 35-year low, according to the Wall Street Journal. And if Zohran Mamdani gets elected mayor of New York, it will almost surely go further to cement the party's sadly earned reputation for urban misgovernment and elite radicalism. All of this leaves plenty to fear, dislike, and even despise when it comes to the Trump administration. We do not strengthen alliances by threatening to seize their territories. We do not diplomatize justice by accusing a former president of treason or threatening to, quote, go after people. We do not safeguard free speech by suing journalists. We do not strengthen the rule of law by shaking down law firms. We do not make America healthy again by promoting medical quackery. Okay. But if Trump's opponents want to someday be effective, and let's face it, we haven't been, then we have to come to grips with the realities that have so far eluded us, such as not everything Trump does is bad. Sometimes the president's bad manners and his over-the-top tactics achieve useful diplomatic or political results. His about-face on Ukraine is a welcome demonstration that he's capable of changing his mind when the facts don't bear him out. Moral hectoring and rarely persuasive are neither inconsistent predictions of doom that never quite materialize. Americans will listen to Democrats when they propose better solutions to common problems, not when they openly root for the administration to fail. I have lambasted the administration over and over again, both in its current and previous terms, and I'm sure I will again. But while it's never fun to be fair to those you dislike, it's also healthy. For criticism to be credible, it cannot be blind. That, again, was written by an individual by the name of Brett Stevens. He is an opinion author and writer over at the New York Times. And that's a very, very interesting piece. Now, some of the things that he claims, some of his criticisms of the Trump administration, I don't believe are necessarily wholly accurate. You know, when he talks about how everything in the first 100 days was a disaster, I don't subscribe to all of that. But I read the piece in its entirety because I think it's a rather interesting one. I think it is an attempt, and I will admit, I did a little bit of research on this guy. He seemingly was kind of an establishment Bush, McCain, Romney, Republican, like many of those individuals, completely flew off the rails back in 2016, has become a staunch anti-Trump guy, and is now closer to being a Democrat than a Republican. So that seems to be a little bit of his backstory, seems to have strong neocon ties, which would explain why the whole giving more money and arming Ukraine is one of his big the things that he says is a win for President Donald Trump. So that's a little bit of the backstory on this guy. But I think what he says, especially in his final two paragraphs, when he talks about how the Democrats are unwilling and have not been able to come to grips with the reality that not everything Trump does is bad, is absolutely hurting their party. It talks about these incessant, this is a direct quote, incessant predictions of doom that never quite materialize. That's exactly the Democrat Party. I mean, Cory Booker, earlier this week, is standing on the floor of the United States House screaming and yelling profanities about this administration, about how democracy itself is coming to an end, how the country itself is completely falling apart in front of us, how the United States will no longer exist thanks to President Donald Trump, thanks to the Republicans. These are exactly what I think the author describes as these incessant predictions of doom. You can't claim, they did it for 4 years the first time, that democracy is going to end under Donald Trump, and then it never does. I've used the boy who cried wolf analogy a lot this week because it's been incredibly accurate. It's the same story. All of these claims that it's all just going to come crumbling down and there won't be an America left if we don't stop Donald Trump are not based in any sort of reality. They are nothing more than gaslighting and fear-mongering tactics from the Democrats and from the progressive left. And what I think they fail to understand, what they fail to grasp, is that you can only say that so many times before people say, you guys are just full of it. The things that you're saying are never happening. The things that you are claiming are never coming to fruition. And to just back this up, here's Cory Booker, the illustrious senator from New Jersey, speaking on the Senate floor earlier this week. Here's just a couple short minutes of him yelling and screaming about the end of democracy and how it's all just crumbling. It's incredibly interesting.
Democratic Party needs a wake-up call. I see law firms bending a knee to this president, not caring about the larger principles, that those free speech rights, that you could take on any client, why are you bending the knee? I see universities that should be bastions of free speech bending at the knee to this president. I see businesses taking late night talk show hosts off the air because they dare to insult a president. I see people who want mergers suddenly think that they have to pay tribute to this president. And what are the very people here elected to defend the Constitution of the United States saying, oh, well, today, let's look the other way and pass some resources that won't go to Connecticut, that won't go to Illinois, that won't go to New York, that will go to the states he likes. That is complicity with an authoritarian leader who is trashing our Constitution.
And so right there, this is an authoritarian leader that's crashing the Constitution. There is nothing that Cory Booker or any other Democrat can point to that shows definitively that President Donald Trump is destroying the Constitution. These are outrageous end of the world doomsday claims that Democrats continue to make that do not ever come to fruition. It's not possible for the president of the United States to so-called destroy the Constitution the way that Cory Booker lines it out. But it doesn't stop him from screaming about how Trump is an authoritarian, I guess.
It's time for Democrats to have a backbone. It's time for us to fight. It's time for us to draw lines. And when it comes to the safety of my state being denied these grants, that's why I'm standing here. Don't question my integrity. Don't question my motives. I'm standing for Jersey. I am standing for my police officers. I'm standing for the Constitution, and I'm standing for what's right. And dear God, if you want to come at me that way, you're going to have to take it up with me, because there's too much on the line right now in America. As people's due process rights and freedom of the speech rights and secret police are running around this country, picking people up off the streets who have a legal right to be here. There's too much going on in this country. When are we going to stand together for principles that I just heard that were agreed with? When are we going to stand together? If we don't stand as Democrats, we deserve to lose. But if we stand united, if we stand strong, if we stand with other people, if we tell with a chorus of conviction in America what this president is doing is wrong, if we stand up and speak that way, dear God, we will win. Like all of those people at our ancestors who join hands.
Jesus. I mean, you talk about an unhinged rant. He's about to have a freaking aneurysm on the floor of the United States Senate. And he's, of course, frustrated with his own party. He believes they're being complicit in helping Donald Trump. How that's happening, I can't wrap my head around. But again, those doomsday predictions, the constant sky is falling, end of the world that Democrats talk about when they claim that Donald Trump is an authoritarian. He is going to destroy our so-called democracy, of course, of which we do not live in a democracy. We live in a democratic republic. Nevertheless, destroying the Constitution, destroying this institution, destroying that institution, stomping on everybody's free speech rights, getting rid of people's due process. These are all the claims that Cory Booker and other Democrats want to make. That America as it exists right now will not exist in 12, 16, 24, 36 months because of evil, awful, terrible, bad orange man Donald Trump. They've been saying and singing off this same sheet of music since 2015, I will remind you. They have been using these exact same talking points now for nearly a decade. And none of it has come to fruition. Trump lost in 2020. There was a Democrat president in the Oval Office from January 18th, 2021, all the way up until January 20th of this year. That doesn't sound like a democracy that's falling. That does not sound like a democracy that is ceasing to exist. You guys won. You controlled the Oval Office, the House, and the Senate from 2021 until the midterm elections in 2022. You guys had complete and total control. Explain to me how that is the work of an authoritarian. Explain to me how that is the work of a dictator. Explain to me how that is the work of a guy who is destroying the democracy, crumpling up the Constitution and throwing it in the garbage. You can't, because it doesn't fit the narrative. It's not based in any sort of fact or reality. It's political posturing. And as things continue to improve, which I am a strong proponent that they will, as the economy continues to course correct, as the Federal Reserve hopefully begins cutting interest rates, which will bring down the cost of purchasing a home, will bring down the cost of purchasing a car, will bring down the cost of small businesses borrowing money so that they can expand and grow and hire more individuals, as the economy continues to grow, which I am a strong believer that it will. As all of that happens, are Democrats still going to run up to the floor of the United States Senate and yell and scream about how the country is going to hell in a handbasket? Are they going to run up to the floor and have an aneurysm on the floor of the United States Senate over the country being destroyed by Donald Trump and the Republicans? If so, I'm a strong believer that this opinion piece by Brett Stevens over at the New York Times will be accurate. That if Democrats continue to openly root for this administration to fail, they are screwed. They will not be able to win elections. They will not be able to win the trust of the American people. And, you know, it's pointed out in this article that according to the Wall Street Journal, the Democrat Party's approval is at a 35-year low. I mean, it's the emperor who has no clothes. They're claiming all of these terrible and awful things are happening, yet reality looks like something very different. So you can only yell and scream and cry on the floor of the United States Capitol for so long before the things that you're claiming have to come true. If not, which they won't, but if they don't come true, then you just look like a clown. Then you look like you're doing nothing more than fear-mongering the American people. You're making these outrageous claims that are never coming to fruition. Now, I will admit, both political parties are guilty of this. But man, the Democrats have put this thing into freaking overdrive. They won't give Donald Trump credit for anything that he does. Mortgage rates will fall. Inflation continues to go down. And they are going to continue to claim that the economy is a disaster. Their disastrous response to immigration has been completely corrected by this administration. And now, they don't want to talk about immigration. They want to talk about and make the claim like Cory Booker did that U.S. citizens are being rounded up by, he calls them secret police. They're not secret police. They're Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're Border Patrol. These are sworn law enforcement officers enshrined in the United States law. They want to claim that all these people are just getting rounded up by secret police. Ooh, it's very Nazi Germany-esque, isn't it? Another one of the Democrat talking points that has not come to fruition at all. These are the same individuals yelling death to Israel, death to the Jews on college campuses, but want to talk about Republicans and Trump being a bunch of Nazis. Sounds very historically accurate, folks. Great work. I'll throw this opinion piece over in our show notes over at patreon.com/Nick Craig if you want to look it up yourself. It's over at the New York Times. The Trump presidency takes a better term. It's written by Brett Stevens over at the New York Times. Kind of an interesting look into what's going on and what some of the narratives are on the left. A pretty interesting piece. Again, it'll be in the show notes over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Well, today is our last show of the week. I've got some traveling I've got to do tomorrow, so we will not be here for the show on your Friday morning to kick off the month of August. However, I will be back a Monday morning here on our live platforms coming up on Monday. Thanks to the law group here in Wilmington for their continued support. Give them a call at 910-251-6088 or visit their website, lawgroupnc.com. That's going to do it for another edition of the Nick Craig Show. Have a great weekend. We're back with you Monday morning live, YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts.